Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week, a protest special as we look at recent events in Budapest and Belgrade, two cities experiencing mass-scale protests in defiance of strongman leaders. And as the UK Parliament votes to prescribe Palestine action, the UN's special rapporteur on counter-terrorism and human rights tells us why he believes this is a big mistake.
In the case of Palestine action, we're concerned that United Kingdom counter-terrorism law treats criminal damage as part of democratic protest as terrorism.
This week, our show begins with a tale of two cities, the Hungarian capital Budapest and the Serbian capital Belgrade. Both Central European countries are governed by leaders characterised by their longevity. Hungary's Viktor Orban has been in power for 15 years, Serbia's Aleksandar Vučić for 12, their friendly predisposition towards Russia and their strongman instincts. And interestingly, while in other parts of Europe and indeed the world, strongmen seem to be having something of a moment, in Hungary and Serbia, the incumbent leaders are looking wobblier than they have for a very long time. Large-scale street protests have become a regular occurrence in both capitals, with last weekend's demonstrations representing a potentially crucial watershed moment for both respective cities. We go to Budapest first, the city where last Saturday some 200,000 people took to the streets in noisy defiance of Viktor Orban's ban on Pride. Our Budapest correspondent Stefan Boss was, of course, out and about amongst the crowds and sent us this report.
It was hot, humid and banned by the government. Yet the Budapest Pride, aimed at promoting LGBTQ plus rights, turned into the biggest anti-government rally since the increasingly authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban returned to power in 2010. An estimated 200,000 people, many armed with rainbow umbrellas and slogans such as love and freedom can't be banned, marched beneath the scorching sunlight for several kilometers or miles from Budapest City Hall to the Technical University. At times, the march resembled a carnival, with several floats ranging from those of advocacy group Amnesty International to Pride organizers, encouraging the crowd to keep up the beat. Among them were numerous European politicians and leaders, such as the mayor of Amsterdam, Femke Halsema, a close friend of Budapest's liberal green mayor. She told Deutsche Welle that she came to the Pride with a special message.
Well, it's very important. To Amsterdam, the value of sexual freedom, of solidarity with the queer movement is essential. It's one of the core values of our city. It is, for me, very important to stand beside Mayor of Budapest, because I think he's very courageous. The national government is intimidating him, and I think European mayors should stand beside him.
Yet, while Halsema could easily leave Hungary, several people participating in the rally admitted to DW they were scared of the repercussions. Hungarian Prime Minister Orban warned those participating in the march of the legal consequences. We are all adults, so reckon with the written, clear legal consequences, he warned on Hungarian radio, adding that police could, of course, disband the protest violently, but that Hungary is a civilized country where this is not the tradition. However, under new so-called child protection legislation, those participating in the march could face some 200,000 Hungarian forints, nearly $600, in fines, while organizers could face up to 1 year imprisonment. Budapest Mayor Gergely Karácsony stated that the law doesn't apply as he organized the gathering as a municipal event, but added little to ease anxiety among those participating in the march, very few people willingly gave their full name, fearing repercussions. Nora, a 32-year-old Hungarian marcher, said she feared facial recognition technology and wore a disguise.
I'm here because I'd like people to be free and to love whomever, and I hate when things get banned, so I want to disprove them by being here. I'm wearing my hat and my disguise. We were joking about wearing a tiny mustache as well. I was a bit afraid for my job, but I'm still here.
Maximilian von Fuchs, who is 29, fled Hungary for Austria, fearing discrimination as a gay man, and was encouraged that there were many people from other countries, such as Germany, Austria, and the Netherlands, participating in the pride.
Sadly, I really want to come home. I used to live here, but with Orban in the position he is in, I could not do the work that I do here. For the one sad fact that my partner is not of the gender he would like it to be.
Police presence was mainly non-confrontational, and small counter-demonstrations, including by perceived far-right groups and conservative Christians, were kept at a distance. The police redirected the pride, crossing a bridge to the Technical University. When the protests arrived, they were welcomed by European leaders such as Nicolae Stefanuta, Vice President of the European Parliament.
Love is love, and that's what the European Union thinks, believes, and acts upon. That's why we are here. Because the decision to restrict and penalize Budapest Pride does not only affect queer people in this country. It sends a dangerous message across the world that you can attack minorities and nothing will happen to you. Well, guess what? When you get the people angry, this is what they do. They show up by the hundreds of thousands of people. We have come here to be with you, to march with you, to face the same dangers as you would face, because we are one of you.
Following the Pride event, several thousand Hungarians continued to protest, saying the demonstrations should persist to prevent the passage of more authoritarian laws ahead of upcoming elections. Visual artist William Theodorakopoulos.
Authoritarianism is real, and we have to take it very seriously. And even though this might seem like a popular protest or about gay rights, this is not about gay rights, it's about civil rights, and ultimately it's really about anti-authoritarianism and pro-democracy. Democracy is critical for everyone's safety.
With Orbán's Fidesz party behind in opinion polls, more protests are expected as Hungary prepares for new elections next year. In the words of organizers, nobody can ban love. Stefan Bos, DW, Budapest.
It's a little quirk of history that whilst Hungarians were marching behind pride flags in Budapest, in neighbouring Serbia, another mass-scale protest was underway, the latest in a series of student-led demonstrations sparked by the Novi Sad train station collapse some 8 months ago, a disaster which protesters firmly believe was caused by construction shortcuts due to endemic corruption. Some 140,000 protesters took to the streets of Belgrade on Saturday, demanding that President Aleksandar Vučić call snap elections or face their continuing dissent. For the first time, the demonstrations were the site of violent clashes with police. DW's Idris Seferi was there, and when we spoke, he described to me how it all unfolded.
There were numerous police units, special units that intervened, and things turned very fast. Brutally, we could hear shock bombs using water cannons, and it was a real fight in streets of Belgrade, which has not been seen at least until from 2020, when people went out to protest against lockdown for COVID, which was also back then very brutal. But this was the first time in this protest, as students claim and want to have this protest peacefully, seeking for changes.
So from your on-the-ground perspective,
How did you experience these violent clashes coming about? What was the dynamic there on the ground?
Well, we didn't know how this will develop. Belgrade has a long history of clashes with police, starting from the 90s when the breakdown of Yugoslavia was taking place and when the wars that split Yugoslavia happened, and people back then, they were opposing the wars and they were seeking for democratic elections. And it was interesting to hear from the President Vucic that the time to face actions came and that the state will not tolerate any more people who want Serbia down and they want to act against the state.
I'm so glad, Itra, that you gave me that sort of history there, because it's about 25 years since public protests did indeed dislodge a president in Serbia. And this fact, this history, is going to be on the minds very much of President Vucic right now, but also of the protesters.
Of course, it happened in 2005 of October, when back then Slobodan Milosevic was withdrawn and later on also sent to the Hague Tribunal for war crimes in ex-Yugoslavia. And a lot of people actually say in Serbia that the 6th of October never happened, meaning that the revolution did happen, but the changes didn't come. And ever since then, there have been problems with governance in Serbia, sometimes better years, but still people are in the streets. And if we would relate this, a lot of parents of the students who protest now also protested since 1997, when the big protests in Serbia started against the regime of Slobodan Milosevic, ending 3 years later. So when you see people talking about it, and also their grandparents sometimes join them, they say that we hope that the students and the young generation will be able to finish what they didn't. And this is bring democratic elections, bring democracy to the country and make a better future. So people who are leaving for better life to EU countries or to other countries, they can stay here and make Serbia a place where they want to live.
That's so interesting, because, you know, that the parallels there between the two men are very thin, right? I mean, you know, Vucic is not a war criminal, but we've got the sense of, when we or when our parents were on the streets 25 years ago, we weren't just against something, we were for an idea of Serbia. And that idea, we feel that we're being denied because of corruption, because of a tendency towards strongman politics. I mean, what's the kind of impulse there, do you think, that's making people draw this connection between past and present right now?
People have waited a long time for changes, and people are used to find their ways to make a living. But I guess a lot of them are tired to live this way or try to solve their problems. They are tired from lists in the hospital when sometimes people have to wait for years to get a surgery, and things that don't actually work, although there is a glimpse of democracy and some institutions function. The reason of this protest is the collapse of the canopy in Novi Sad railway station when 16 people died. So they blame institutions for not reacting, prosecutors, judges. So they want that institutions act and react when things are going wrong. And this seems that it's not always happening.
Right. But I mean, arguably, you know, that Novi Sad train disaster, which was awful and which shocked the nation and which protesters believe very strongly was due to corners that were cut due to corruption, right? But arguably, they've already won so many concessions, you know, not least the removal of a prime minister. And yet, still the momentum continues. The demand now is very clear. It's snap elections. And snap elections mean the chance to show dissatisfaction with and potentially vote for something other than what Vucic and his party are offering.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. In this country, as in many of Western Balkan region, all what it is, it's about one man. So it's related to figures who lead the country. And this is President Aleksandar Vučić.
I was talking to Idros Seferi, a Belgrade-based reporter specializing in the Western Balkans region for DW. Next up in this protest special, Palestine action and why UN experts are warning that its prescription poses a threat to democracy. That's here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock. On Wednesday, the UK Parliament voted to prescribe three groups under terrorist legislation. Maniac's Murder Cult, a white supremacist neo-Nazi organisation. The Russian Imperial Movement, a white supremacist ethno-nationalist organisation. And, controversially, Palestine Action, a group known for its staging of direct actions targeting UK-based entities involved in arms manufacturing linked to Israel's war in Gaza. Ahead of the vote, a group of senior UN experts authored a public statement urging the British government not to prescribe Palestine Action. The lead signatory of that document was Professor Ben Saul, UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms while Countering Terrorism. I spoke to him shortly before the vote was passed and asked him to outline his concerns to me.
In the case of Palestine Action, we're concerned that United Kingdom counter-terrorism law treats criminal damage as part of democratic protest as terrorism. And according to best practice international standards, including those issued by the United Nations Security Council, mere property damage, even if it's criminal, should not be treated as terrorism. According to those international standards, terrorism should be reserved for acts which are intended to cause and do cause death or serious injury. And that's not the case with Palestine Action.
And in terms of the concrete consequences of the prescription of Palestine Action from the perspective of someone in the UK wanting to protest in solidarity with Palestine or against UK support for Israel, what would those consequences be?
It would have some pretty serious effect on chilling the exercise of freedom of expression and association and assembly and what we call the right to participate in public life through protest and demonstrations. The effect of prescribing an organization is that it triggers liability of individuals for a whole raft of criminal offenses, including being a member of that group, providing support for the group, even helping it to hold a meeting is a criminal offence. And some of these offences can attract a term of imprisonment of 14 years, which is grossly disproportionate to the nature of those acts. If you think about it, what happens here is that because some members of the group may have committed criminal damage, which the government calls terrorism, the whole group is banned, and all of those interactions by other members who could be completely innocent. They haven't committed property damage. They're not intending to injure or kill anybody. All of those activities become criminal all of a sudden. And of course, conduct of those innocent people is protected under international human rights law as the right to protest and to freely express oneself. I think it demonstrates just how banning an organization like this, which is not of its nature purely criminal or terrorist, has these incredibly disproportionate effects because it sweeps up and criminalizes legitimate protest activity by other members of the organization. Now, if members of groups like this who engage in direct action or civil disobedience do cause property damage to, say, defense installations or arms companies, which they target to prevent their alleged involvement in the conflict in Gaza, then ordinary criminal offenses are the appropriate way to deal with those harms. You know, prosecute somebody for malicious damage to property or for trespass on a military base. But it's wildly disproportionate to call them terrorists and to ban the whole organization and all of its members as terrorists.
Can I ask you about parallels and precedents? And I mean, given that I'm talking to you as I swelter in the midst of a European heatwave, the one that immediately occurs is, of course, climate protest. Could the prescription of Palestine Action have implications for other types of protests like climate protest?
It certainly could. And as we know, in many countries, governments have cracked down in a pretty heavy-handed manner on all kinds of contemporary protest. I mean, not just protest over Gaza or the wars in the Middle East, but climate protest as well of various kinds. I mean, that's been a phenomenon in a number of European countries as well as further afield. So I think it does set a really unfortunate precedent, which makes it easier to open the door to government repression of other kinds of groups engaged in protest as well. I mean, think about some other common kinds of protest in democracies, trade unions and labor disputes and industrial protest. You know, strike action can sometimes get a bit unruly, but nobody thinks trade unionists fighting for the rights of workers should ordinarily be treated as terrorism. And if you think of some real-life examples in my lifetime, I remember back during the Iraq War in 2003, some protesters painted in red paint a sign saying no war on the sails of the Opera House in Sydney. That caused hundreds of thousands of dollars of property damage in order to force the Australian government not to engage in an illegal war against Saddam Hussein's Iraq on the pretext of disarming it of weapons of mass destruction. That satisfies the definition of terrorism, and yet nobody in Australia would seriously think that that kind of act should be treated as terrorism, let alone lead to the banning of a protest group and the criminalization of all of its members. Another example, years ago, trade unionists protested outside the Australian Parliament. It got out of hand. They pushed through the police barrier. They broke down the glass doors at the front of Parliament House, causing very serious economic damage because it smashed up the doors. They looted the gift shop and stole, coffee mugs of some prime ministers and not others. But again, nobody would really consider that this should be treated as terrorism or lead to the banning of trade unions who organised that protest.
Professor Ben Saul, thank you very much for talking to me.
Good to be with you.
I was speaking to Professor Ben Saul, UN Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism and Human Rights. Meanwhile, in Gaza, the renowned cardiologist and hospital director, Dr. Mehwan Al-Sultan, became the 70th healthcare worker to be killed by Israeli attacks in the last 50 days. That's according to Healthcare Workers Watch, a Palestinian medical organization. Dr. Mehwan was killed alongside several of his family members. We'll be finding out more about the implications of governmental crackdowns on the right to protest after the break. If you're listening via a partner station that leaves us here, you can still listen via our podcast feed. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
Hot dust in the sky on a winter's day. Plastic bottles in the sea a thousand miles away. Acid rain from the clouds turn the trees to grey. Playing Russian roulette with our future. Vapor trails smoke the sky like a cigarette. Politicians ride the skies in a private jet. Seems they haven't realized the situation yet. Self-destruction is the etiquette. We're smoking the future like a cigarette. We're smoking the future like a cigarette. We're smoking the future like a cigarette. We're smoking the future like a cigarette.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. It has been a hot week in Europe, record-breakingly hot, in fact. As I record this, the weather in Bonn has hit 38 degrees Celsius. That's over 100 degrees Fahrenheit and climbing. Some more southerly regions are recording temperatures of over 41 degrees Celsius. That's over 105.8 degrees Fahrenheit. European summers, they're not supposed to be like this. Deaths have been reported. In Spain, farmland is burning. The Pope has written a public letter in which he says our Earth is being ravaged. Extreme natural phenomena caused by climate changes provoked by human activity are growing in intensity and frequency, the Pope says, to say nothing of the medium and long-term effects of the human and ecological devastation being wrought by armed conflicts. And yet, the wars continue and the world continues to burn fossil fuels. Not surprising, then, that some citizens decide to get organised, to join climate protests or to stage actions demanding change or hindering the business of extraction. In response, governments across Europe and beyond have been cracking down on the right to protest. They say activists have crossed the line into extremism. The activists, in their turn, say that given that all we know about the existential threat of climate breakdown, it's the pursuit of business as usual that's the real extremism. So, as the repression intensifies, will it crush the movement or make it stronger? It's a question that my colleague, Charlie Shield, looked into back in March for a Living Planet deep dive entitled How Far Will Governments Go to Stop Climate Protests?
Environmental protest is not new. It's got a long history.
The sound of victory for the Standing Rock Sioux and thousands of others gathered to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. This massive humanity...
Pictures coming in just moments ago. Police moving in right there to make their arrests.
The protesters began gathering here last April, opposing the construction of the 1,200-mile Dakota Access Pipeline.
But in 2018 and 2019, climate protests started to get big. Like, really big.
Global Day of Climate Action has begun, including hundreds of... Unions, workers, and other supporters of the Fridays for Future movement have joined students in a march...
Millions of people across the world were showing up for the climate cause, making it known that they wanted action on climate change. And they were willing to take to the streets or skip school to get the message across.
Of course, the climate crisis hasn't disappeared, and we have not disappeared. The concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere hasn't been this high for at least 3 million...
Then, in 2020, 2021, it was harder to protest on a big scale. Remember the pandemic we had? Anyway, while it did slow things down, the message was already out there, and there was no stopping it. Governments and fossil fuel groups noticed the growing swell of climate-conscious citizens. And a lot of them didn't like it.
More than 1,500 climate activists have been arrested at an anti-fossil fuel protest in the Netherlands. The event...
We're going to stay here until they drag us away. The climate change is an unfolding crisis. We know the cause, and it's still being subsidized by our government.
Around 2022, a chunk of the climate movement started to change their tactics. Governments were still investing in coal, oil, and gas, something the overwhelming majority of climate scientists say we need to stop using as quickly as possible to turn the tide on deadly climate change. Time was of the essence. More attention was needed.
So it was November. It was grey and cold. And it was dark. We started at 4 o'clock on the dot, so it was getting dark at that time of year. And there were lots of people bustling around.
This is Andy. In November 2023, on Remembrance Day, which is the UK's version of Veterans Day, he was part of a non-violent protest, disrupting traffic on one of London's main shopping streets.
I was with about 40 other Just Stop Oil protesters who'd come from different parts of London, and we'd all assembled at this point. We all talked to each other, had a check-in, because it's a scary thing. So we all talked to each other, we talked about how we were feeling, reassured each other that, you know, we were doing something positive for the world.
Andy and the group waited for the traffic light to turn red before they stepped out. They were wearing high visibility vests and holding a bright orange banner that read, "Just Stop Oil." Some protesters stayed on the sidewalk to explain to passers-by what the protest was all about.
So we entered the road at 4 p.m. and we walked slowly for about 30 minutes. It was a bit like we were a slow-moving bus. That's what we're often trained to think of ourselves as, a slow-moving bus. And so people could overtake us. So it wasn't a complete obstruction in the road, but it was enough to draw people's attention.
It was also enough to draw their ire.
People do get upset at the fact that you are hampering their ability to travel. But we are very careful. We're trained to get out of the way when there are blue lights, specifically ambulances, but other emergency services as well.
And then the police arrived.
This police van kind of screamed like down the road coming towards us and like pulled across the road in front of us and blocked the road. There had been a much bigger protest earlier in the day at the main war memorial in London, where there were far right protesters of the English Defence League, and there were fights between the English Defence League and the police. And so we got a real sense that, you know, we had some of the same police and they were hyped up.
Soon enough, Andy was arrested for willful obstruction of traffic, alongside about 30 other protesters.
He handcuffed my hands in front of me. He read me my rights, as it were. And at that point, I then started to tell him about why I was there protesting. I was, as a science writer, I'd been at some...
As a science writer, Andy is better acquainted than most with how climate change is warping the planet and breaking down ecosystems that we need for survival. The more he learns, the more motivated he is to do something about it. So, lately, he's become a climate activist too, with Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil. You've probably heard of Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil in the news before. They're climate groups who've become pretty well known for their stunts. Disrupting traffic is a popular one, as well as scaling buildings and bridges to unfurl their banners, chucking soup at famous paintings, gluing their hands to walls, spray painting their messages across the city, even throwing cornstarch on Stonehenge.
Protesters from Just Stop Oil had climbed gantries over London's orbital motorway, delaying an estimated 180,000 journeys.
Security!
You may have seen this UK climate action group throwing soup over Van Gogh's sunflowers at the National Gallery in London, or its members tying themselves to goalposts during Premier League.
And so we need to act. And that was the reason I was there for the protest, was to try and get that message across, to try and tell people how urgent this is, because the message isn't really getting across.
Andy empathises with people's frustration about their disruptive tactics. But ultimately, he says he's motivated by something that feels bigger than his momentary discomfort.
Now, you know, obviously they're frustrated by the fact that we are slowing them down and making it harder for them to get to the places that it's going to, but you know, perhaps that might make them think, well, you know, they think this is serious enough to do this. Why is that?
After his arrest, Andy ended up having to spend a night in jail, something he's not in a hurry to do again. He was eventually acquitted of the charge. At the time of arrest, he was technically standing on a traffic island, so he wasn't actually obstructing traffic, the judge found. But recently, other climate activists haven't been so lucky.
Governments, including the United States, are cracking down and even jailing climate protesters. The group Climate Rights International...
An environmental activist has been jailed for repeatedly breaching a suspended sentence. 28-year-old Ali...
The controversial Police and Crime Bill would grant police greater powers to crack down...
In mid-2024, five Just Stop Oil activists in the UK were arrested for taking part in a video call to plan a four-day protest on a major motorway in London. They were eventually found guilty of conspiring to cause public nuisance. Four of them were sentenced to 4 years in prison. One was sentenced to 5 years. Those are the longest sentences ever handed down in the UK for non-violent protest. The UN Special Rapporteur for Environmental Defenders said the sentences were unacceptable in a democracy. Human Rights Watch described the new powers granted to police and courts in the UK as draconian, saying they undermined free speech, peaceful assembly and democratic rights.
So, like, it's only really emerging what effect the Public Order Act in the UK is having on protest, or on protesters, rather. So the Home Office have just kind of released data which show that their new powers under the Public Order Act are used, like 95% of it is used against environmental protest.
That's Oscar Berlund, a Swedish-Peruvian political economist at Bristol University. He researches climate change activism and civil disobedience. And he's talking about new anti-protest laws in the UK. But the crackdown is a global trend, something that his team recently detailed in a report they published. Alongside the UK, many other countries like the US, Australia, Brazil, Peru and Germany have also come down hard on climate protesters. One way they're doing this is through legal intimidation tactics. For example, by using existing laws that target organised crime or terrorists to sentence protesters. Or, in the case of the US, by passing critical infrastructure bills that allow them to hand down heftier penalties to protesters who are targeting the oil and gas industry. There's also more leeway for police to use force and for judges to hand down longer prison sentences. And even though climate protesters' tactics have become more confrontational, the movement is extensively committed to non-violence. And Oscar says it's not like authorities didn't already have the rights to deal with them.
The police have had powers to deal with these types of protests. They can, you know, carry people away, and you know, they don't need to have special powers to stop people going to normal protests, to, you know, hand down the kind of prison sentences that we are seeing now.
So why the repression?
Obviously, there's always been crackdown on protest, and when, you know, a protest gets annoying to the powers that be, then they crack down on it. The pandemic came just after a really intense period of climate protest, and arguably the time when climate protest has been the biggest around the world, and the most efficient at kind of the most efficient at changing climate politics, at influencing climate politics, at changing the way that climate change is talked about in the media and so on, increasing concern about climate change amongst the population.
Climate and environmental protests have had a real impact. Direct action has stopped fracking, mining, pipeline and extraction projects around the world. And perhaps most impactfully, more people are aware of it. Between mid-2018, when Greta Thunberg started Fridays for Future, and September 2019, Google searches containing climate change were found to have multiplied tenfold. For some groups and governments, especially those reliant on exporting fossil fuels, that's a real threat. Investigative journalists have linked the fossil fuel lobby to a wave of anti-protest laws in the US and beyond. Lobby groups such as ALEC, Marathon Petroleum, American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers have all pushed anti-protest legislation, even drafting some legislation, in multiple states across the US, like Idaho, Ohio and West Virginia. Lawmakers warn that anti-protest measures could affect everyone's rights to stand up for anything. But when it comes to implementing those laws, different causes do tend to be treated differently.
When you look at it from the European perspective, when the farmers protest, for example, with their tractors in cities, then the police doesn't seem to really do anything about that.
Oscar's talking about a type of farmer protest that's become common in European countries, like Germany and the Netherlands. where farmers drive their tractors into the city, blocking roads and ports.
European Union agriculture ministers are meeting in Brussels after weeks of protest by farmers across the bloc.
That is a smouldering, burning pile of tyres. We've seen farmers also adding bales of hay into this blaze. And
often, they're not met with arrests or police violence or negative media coverage, even though some of them have turned violent and become dangerous for bystanders and politicians. Far-right violence has also seen shorter sentences handed out than those given to climate protesters. In August 2024, rioters in the UK were found guilty of assaulting police, setting buildings and police vans alight, and racially aggravated violence. They were sentenced to between 1 and 3 years in prison, just 1 month after Just Stop Oil activists were given 4 and 5 year sentences. And then, if we take an extreme example of this discrepancy, there's the storming of Capitol Hill, where the average prison sentence for the 550 rioters found guilty of criminal offences was under 3 years.
And it's worth noting here that a lot of the sentences for climate activists who were engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience that involved very minimal property destruction, the sentences were substantially higher than those who were convicted of participating in the January 6th insurrection against the U.S. government, which involved violence, where people died and extensive property damage happened at the U.S. Capitol. I mean, these were people who literally built guillotines on the U.S. Capitol grounds with the express intention of murdering elected members of the U.S. government. And those people were sentenced to lower times in jail. I mean, and they've now been pardoned by our new president.
Back in office, Donald Trump pardoned more than 1,500 people convicted over the storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, 2021.
Hi, I'm Dana R. Fisher. I am the director of the Center for Environment, Community, and Equity and a professor in the School of International Service at American University. I'm also the author of Saving Ourselves, From Climate Shocks to Climate Action.
Dana is based in Washington. She's been studying protest movements for 20 years. And that's long enough to notice some trends among them. One major one being when parts of a movement start to escalate their tactics. This phenomenon has a name. It's called the radical flank effect.
Research shows that as this, what we call radical flank, spills off and people become more confrontational, that it actually helps drive support for the broader movement.
We've seen it many times in movements gone before. The civil rights movement, the suffragettes' fight for women to vote, anti-apartheid in South Africa. Martin Luther King Jr. himself was wildly unpopular while he was alive.
Sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day...
So people who are not supportive of the movement are not going to change their minds because people decided that they're going to sit in a restaurant or they're going to sit in and block traffic. That is not going to change hearts and minds. What it does do is it is very effective at getting more media attention for the cause.
And that, Dana says, actually attracts people. People who feel like they need to do something, but they haven't gotten involved yet. So the radical flank is a familiar feature of social movements. And so too, it turns out, are punitive responses.
When the state starts to feel threatened, by a movement intends to be more aggressive and repressive. But we also see violence in some cases. I mean, certainly we saw that during the civil rights movement. And I expect we're going to be seeing that sooner or, you know, in the near future. Let me say it that way.
Dana means violence from law enforcement against protesters, nonviolent protesters. If that happens and it's witnessed by a wide public audience, she says that often that tends to attract more support for the cause.
This is one of the reasons that climate activists are so committed to nonviolent civil disobedience. The nonviolence is key because they very much have been trained and schooled in the ways that this process works. But if there's violence against them and repression against them, it actually draws out many sympathizers who had not yet stood up and pushed back.
And so what Dana is saying is, although this path of resistance is, in a way, a well-trodden one, it might get worse before it gets better. Oscar Berlund is not convinced the confrontational tactics of climate activists are necessarily helpful for the climate movement. but he is convinced by the motivations behind them.
You know, I don't necessarily think that it's a good approach to throw soup at paintings or to glue yourself to a motorway.
Security!
I mean, ultimately, the people that are being sent to prison for 4 or 5 years, they might engage in a type of protest that you know, many people, most people, find, you know, inconvenient and a bit stupid and silly. But they do so from a place of caring immensely for humanity and the planet, and they do not do so in self-interest. They absolutely do not do so in self-interest. So to send people like that to prison for 4 or 5 years is, I think, not in the public interest. I mean, what I think is really important is to acknowledge that this is part of climate politics, and the real villains in climate politics, they're not being sent to prison. The countries that are allowing this to happen, and more specifically, you know, the fossil fuel industry, they're not facing consequences, and the crimes that they are committing are a lot worse than gluing yourself to a motorway.
Six months after Andy's arrest for disrupting traffic on a London road, the Labour Party were voted in the UK. They announced that they would not be issuing any new coal, oil and gas licences. Andy's convinced protests played a part in helping make that decision. There's still a long way to go to phase out fossil fuels and bring down emissions, he says. And for now, he's still figuring out the best way to help. But he doesn't have any regrets.
What I've found in the protest movement, actually, is that there are really some truly wonderful people, and there's actually a lot of joy. The people who do these protests, they really, really care. This is a big thing. It's really, really scary to step out into the road. There are people shouting at you. There are people honking their horns. That takes an awful lot of courage. And then to risk arrest and jail as well. You have to be brave, and as scary as things are, I'm really proud to be a part of that.
We're up here until the government makes a meaningful
statement. You've been listening to Charlie Shields' Living Planet Deep Dive, How Far Will Governments Go to Stop Climate Protests? Edited by Kathleen Schuster. Sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. Heard here on Inside Europe.
Poison in the water, poison in the rain, poison in the water, but still the fact remains. You deny it ever happened, deny it ever will, deny it ever happened, but it keeps on happening still.
Finally this week, a piece first broadcast by our partners over at The World from PRX and GBH. It's about Perrier. You know, that rather classy-feeling French natural mineral water that comes in those elegant green bottles. Or is it natural mineral water? Because if filtration is involved, then that label is in jeopardy. Here's The World's Jerry Haddon with this sobering draft.
The one bar on the main square in Vergès, it has no name. It just says sports bar on the awning. So much for branding. But inside, you can bet they serve the town's world-famous brand of natural mineral water. Bartender Fabien Verchave serves up my Perrier with ice and a slice of lemon. This is the drink that's kept this town fizzing along for more than a century and a half.
Le plus traditionnel, c'est le, bien sûr, c'est le jet Perrier. Après, oui, on a des apéros spritz.
There's Perrier straight up, Verschave tells me, handing me mine. But we also use it in mixed drinks, he says. For example, our Perrier spritzer. We have lots of combinations. There's so much sparkling water under the ground around Vergès, you could use it in the local fountains, which, of course, the town doesn't do, but you get the point. Perrier, now owned by the Swiss food giant Nestle, extracts about a billion bottles of bubbly water a year from area aquifers. Perrier is very important to the village, says Verschaf. It pays a lot of taxes to source its water here, he says, and a lot of residents work over in the factory or live off their Perrier pensions. Perrier's massive bottling plant is less than a mile out of town. Here, trucks come and go day and night, but this bustling operation is in danger. Last year, French health authorities found contaminants in two of Perrier's local wells. Perrier had to recall some 3 million bottles. Bernard Schmidt is an environmental activist with a group called Eau, or Water 88, in France.
Plus de 30% de la surface est utilisée par des agriculteurs qui utilisent.
He says about 30% of the farmers near the wells use pesticides, and there's a lot of livestock around too. The soil here is porous, he says, so rainwater seeps quickly down into the groundwater, carrying with it those pesticides, animal fecal matter, and bacteria. Health authorities also found traces of PFAs, or forever chemicals, as they're known. Over at the Nestlé Perrier plant, security guards tell me no one is available for comment. Representatives have not responded to an online inquiry either. But this week, the president of Nestlé Waters France, Sophie Dubois, testified before a Senate committee investigating the company.
Aujourd'hui, près de 1500 analyses sont réalisées chaque jour.
We conduct about 1,500 tests on our water each day at our facility, she said, to guarantee the safety of our products. But despite Dubois' assurances, health authorities warned in a leaked report in December that Perrier might have to shut down its Vergès operation due to poor water quality. Scientists say climate change is likely to accelerate aquifer contamination because extreme rainfall means there's more water to carry toxins underground. You could always filter the contaminants out, but that would mean losing the natural designation in natural mineral water. Lose that, and Perrier could lose its reputation, not to mention its ability to sell its water for a premium price.
Did you find the place?
I'll call you back.
Welcome to Maison Perrier, at the heart of the enchanting south of France.
It seems Perrier has seen the writing on the well. It's actually embraced filtering, though in a new line of flavored sparkling water. This ad is for its water Maison Perrier. It stars the main character Emily from the TV show Emily in Paris.
Dive into a world full of flavors and sparkling sensations.
Whether Perrier is hedging its bets or just trying to expand its market share, what's clear is that Europe's water is in trouble. An investigative report from last year called Under the Surface analyzed EU country data. It found that over 15% of Europe's aquifers are dangerously contaminated or overexploited. The situation is worst in countries that grow the most food, among them Spain, Germany, and France. But in the French village of Vergès, Perrier HQ, residents aren't buying the doom and gloom.
Pour nous, le Perrier n'est pas pollué, n'est pas contaminé. Pour le moment, il n'y a aucune preuve.
Nope, says bartender Fabien Verschave, shaking his head. Perrier is not contaminated. We have full faith in the company and the local workers. My sales, he says, have not dropped one bit. For now. But authorities are monitoring Perrier's water closely. And if more toxic runoff turns up, the company might have to go full on with the filtering, striking the word natural from its famous green bottles.
The World's Jerry Haddon there, bringing us to the end of the show. This week's edition of Inside Europe was produced by myself, Kate Laycock, and newly minted Inside Europe recruit, Laura Kabelka. Welcome to the team, Laura. Our sound engineer was the unflappable Jan Winkelmann. Our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. And you can also leave us a voice memo via speakpipe.com/InsideEurope. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.